Look, first of all, I'd really like to thank Dr. Mohan for inviting me to the workshop, and also the University of Sydney for sponsoring my visit. I've been working with, just a little bit of background, I have a background in agricultural extension. I used to be an extension officer in Australia for many years, working with cattle farmers. And after I did my PhD, which was about rural sociology, I got into the field of evaluating extension or evaluating how to work with farmers. And my work has mainly been in Laos. So I'm going to show some case studies today of how we've scaled out livestock management practices in Laos. And I fell, just by default, I guess, I fell into this area of evaluating how you scale out and documenting the process, both the, and the outcomes, the potential negative as well as positive outcomes from scaling out. So that's what I'm going to cover today. There is one of my papers in the proceedings there. It's one that was published a couple of years ago, and that's basically what I'm going to follow, really. So you can read that later at your leisure. All right, so what I'm going to talk about, we'll go to the next slide, a little bit of theory about how we define scaling up and out, because they can be very confusing terms. I'm going to show a little bit about how it works and also how it doesn't work, because it's very easiest to focus for us to focus on the success stories, but there's also a lot of examples out there of where people have tried to scale up and it hasn't worked, and it's important to understand why. And a lot of it revolves around understanding how farmers like to learn and the role of extension, which is what NACSA has been doing. We'll look at some key success factors that you have if you're going to scale up. And I'm sure just what I heard yesterday is that the examples here in India, a lot of those success factors have been in place, and that's why it has been successful. I'll use a case study from Laos to highlight, and then my take-home messages, I'm actually going to show a little digital story that we've been using digital stories in Laos as an extensions tool with farmers. Very easy to make these, so to show them what other farmers are doing to scale out ideas, and I'll use that as my take-home message. Okay, next one. So what is scaling up and out? Scaling out and up are terms increasingly being used to describe a desired expansion of beneficial impacts from agricultural research and rural development. They're often used interchangeably in the rural development literature. That's what I found when I started writing my paper. I prefer to use these definitions. They're set up by the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research, which is CGIAR. A lot of the agriculture research centres come under the umbrella of CGIAR. I suppose it's a little bit like NACA. And they define scaling out as the geographical spread of a technology or practice or systems over time, so going from one district to a province, etc., whereas scaling up refers to expanding beneficial initiatives and practices within and across an institution, a network or an organisation. So what you've been doing through NACA and NACSA and all the organisations here, that's what in the literature they refer to scaling up as the institutional side, whereas scaling...
Yeah.
Too loud, is it?
No, not too loud. There's what? Some disturbance.
Ah, right, okay. So scaling up is the institutional, scaling out is spreading the technology to more farmers. Both mechanisms are needed to achieve widespread and significant systems change. So in my paper, I referred to the whole process as scaling out, but for this purpose of this workshop, I've used the term scaling up. So you can, even though they refer to different things, to generalise, you can't keep saying scaling out and scaling up all the time. So to generalise, we tend to use one term or another. So it's a little bit like do we use good management practices or do we use better? It's semantic, really. But really, at the end of the day, the aim is to enable more really good, equitable and sustainable benefits to reach more people. That's really what it's about. If you go to the next slide, this is a definition which I really like. The scaling up is not just replication of technologies. It's not just about getting BMPs. Well, it is about getting BMPs adopted and used by more people. But if we only focus on that, we forget the other important aspects, which is It's about adaptation and learning that's flexible and interactive. It's really about people, and this is what Zumala was emphasising in her talk yesterday. We mustn't forget to focus on the people aspect. It's about communicating options to people, letting them decide what's important for them or not, and it might be that they decide that BMPs are not for them. So we've done our job if we've helped people to decide that important decision. And about farmers' abilities to adapt. So what this quote really is saying is that the quality of the process and the impacts from scaling up are just as important as the quantity of impact, particularly in terms of social equity and sustainability. Okay, so there's some of the theory. You can read more in the paper about the theory. The first couple of pages are all about the theory of scaling out. So now, how easy is it to do it in practice? Let's have a look at the practice side. This little diagram here just shows you, and you're probably all familiar with this, that it's very easy to get adoption or use of a technology if it's just a single use, something like adopting a new feed in a shrimp pond system. You don't need much in the way of solid social skills or extension for that. But as you start increasing the number of practice changes required, that's where you need people involved that have good communication skills. You're going to need more extension, more staff in the field. And particularly when you get up to what you're dealing with cluster groups, coordinated practice change becomes very complex. And it's important to realise what's happened, I think, particularly in agricultural science and rural development, is that a lot of projects start off trialling technologies with farmers on a small scale, and they just assume that it'll scale out by itself, that if they work away at this area here, that farmers will just take off and start doing these other things by themselves. But it doesn't just happen by itself, as you've found. It needs strong facilitation and it needs a lot of planning and strategy, and it takes a long time. So what I've found in working with research and development is too often little attention is paid to understanding how technologies impact on people's lives and how they fit into the whole farm livelihood and community system. So if scientists are unaware of the subtle social, cultural and environmental differences between communities, then negative impacts from interventions can occur. Numerous cases exist of social inequities, environmental degradation and a loss of cultural connection arising from inappropriate technologies and scaling out processes. Now I'll show you some examples of how the potential negative impacts of scaling out, which is initially perceived as, you know, a good thing, how that can happen. So the two examples I'm going to show you, one is the use of portable sawmills in Papua New Guinea. So these portable sawmills were introduced to enable communities to log individual trees in a sustainable sense and to be able to make money from that timber. So they could get them easily into the village. It means the villagers could process, you know, this is value adding for their own community. Great idea. So they trained some individuals in how to work the portable sawmills. But what happened was that those individuals were the ones that made the money from the wood. They then left the village because they had the money to do so and went off into town. And in some cases, they spent the money on grog and all sorts of inappropriate things, which then left the people left in the village who weren't trained to then use the sawmills. So what happened was that they started having lots of accidents because these people weren't trained in the safety measures. There was no one there to maintain the sawmills. They got rusty, more and more dangerous, and in the end they were just abandoned. So initially the idea of scaling out portable sawmills ended up having a negative impact on the community. The people who used them initially were the ones that made the money and nicked off, and the people, so it wasn't equitable and it wasn't sustainable. So that's an example from Papua New Guinea. We've got an example here in Australia where back in the 70s and 80s, we had a big problem, and we still have the problem in southern Australia with salinity caused by clearing of vegetation. So there was a big push to plant more trees, have tree plantations, to control salinity, control erosion, and to have more timber and income for the country. So a lot of farmland was planted up with blue gums, mostly eucalypts, a bit of pine, on private land. But what that led to was both environmental impacts in terms of, okay, it lowered the water table, but it actually reduced the available water, the runoff for farms in terms of dams. So the farmers started complaining about, hey, this plantation behind me is taking away my water. That was environmental impact, plus the risk of fire. Having a huge plantation on your doorstep meant that your place was more risky for fire. And the social impacts were that more and more farmland being planted to trees, people started to move away. You know, there was loss of farmland, there was loss of community. So in these areas where lots of plantations have gone in, like Western Victoria, in some cases schools had to close, just no community. So good idea to begin with, yeah, let's plant more trees, but and scale it out, more and more trees, more and more plantations, great idea. But they didn't think through the environmental and social impacts. So this is what we have to be really careful of when we get excited about scaling out something that's had a local success. Be aware of the potential negative impacts on scaling out. Okay, negative impacts aside, more common outcomes of attempts to scale out complex or risky technologies, often it ends up with low farmer uptake or a decline in farmer participation over time, usually due to a lack of understanding of the farmer learning process. So I tend to, what I've noticed is amongst scientists and even social scientists, this fixation about adoption, that people either adopt or they don't adopt, instead of understanding that farmers adapt and trial things over time and that they may not use your BMP exactly as you wish or instruct to do so. The other problem is the misunderstanding that farmers need to keep learning and improving over a long time. And, you know, practice change can take up to 5 to 10 years. The problem we do have, and I was talking to Simon over breakfast this morning, with projects being only funded for 3 to 4 years, the short-term nature of many projects and the lack of impact evaluation, which is what we were talking about yesterday, well, you know, we haven't documented the evidence or the success of what we're doing, often results in a lack of learning as to why farmers' uptake has been slow or why communities have been resistant. This short-term approach fails to understand that practice change can take many years of farmer trialing and adapting. The other complication we have sometimes is that governments get excited and start throwing incentives at farmers to try and speed up the process of getting them to use the technology and increase production. So sometimes a project may appear successful if incentives encourage early participation and uptake. It's like, oh, you beauty, yep. Throw some money at people and away you go, you know, we've got some action. However, if farmer participation is only because of the incentives, their learning and commitment will not be sustainable. And I think this is recognised within the Shrimp BMP that Arun has this great slide where with a big incentive plus little service, you don't go anywhere. But if you have a small amount of incentive and subsidy, like you've done with the NUXA program, and a lot of services and support, then you'll get good results. So the other important aspect of farmer learning is realising that farmers mostly learn from experience and each other. So getting that peer-to-peer learning happening. But not everybody will trial things straight away. So some farmers like to sit back and watch others have a go first. And like everyone, farmers have different learning styles. We all like to learn in different ways. So it might be that some people prefer to learn through talking and discussing. Other people prefer to read something, learn on the job. So if we're going to scale up successfully, we have to cater for these different types of learning styles. And I'll show you how we've done that in the case of Laos with foragers and technology. So from the literature, I'm just going to present some of the key success factors to scaling up, and then I'll show you how we managed to apply those in Laos. And you can also think about whether this is what has led to your success in India. The first one is that if you're going to scale up, you have to have clear and tangible benefits for farmers and target groups. They've got to be able to see. The old adage of seeing is believing. You've got to have strong leadership and facilitation over the long term, and I've seen really good examples from NACSA and with your cluster leaders that that's been one of your key success factors. Lots of peer-to-peer learning, farmer-to-farmer learning. You've got to have support from officials and donors, and that's what we're going to be talking about over the next couple of days, is how to continue and perhaps increase that for scaling out in India. Presence of market drivers does help. You don't necessarily have to have that, though, and I'll show you that examples from Laos indicates that. Availability of credit and security of land tenure, very important, just to enable people to get into the practice. Strong civil society helps, and also a history of relevant experience in the country. And yesterday when Richard was presenting our experiences in Indonesia, I went through this and just put little ticks and crosses. I think what we've observed in Indonesia is that we don't have clear and tangible benefits yet for the farmers there. We haven't been able to show them that BMPs really do work, because we've had environmental and social impacts there. We don't have strong leadership and facilitation yet. We're just starting to get some peer-to-peer learning happening, and Mardiana has and our gang are the ones that have been facilitating that farmer-to-farmer learning in Java and Sulawesi, so we're starting along that. We've got really good support from the Indonesian government and ACR. The market drivers are there. The Indonesian government's saying, yes, we want to produce more shrimp, so no problem there. We don't have availability of credit for the farmers at this stage. They've got incentives that get thrown at them from time to time, but not ongoing credit. And for some farmers, they don't own the ponds, so security of land tenure. Strong civil society, yes. And we don't, in Indonesia, we don't have a history of relevant experience in the country. So for our Indonesian farmers, we haven't got really good examples to show them yet. So Richard's been talking this morning about, well, perhaps we need to bring them to India to stimulate and to show them what can be done with farmers that are in a similar situation. Okay, so there's some of the success factors. Now I'm going to talk a bit about, show an example of what we've been doing in Laos and how we scaled out livestock. Am I going for time? Okay, so the Forage and Livestock Systems Project, funded by the Australian government under AusAid. So it wasn't ACR, it wasn't Research for Development, it was an actual development program funded by aid. So it was established in 2000 to build the capacity of national, provincial and district government staff in expanding the use of forages by farmers in two upland provinces, these two here, Luang Prabang and Zengkuang. So this is very mountainous, remote area of Laos. The project started with two provincial coordinators and 12 district staff who selected 18 villages that were known to have feed shortages but with the potential for increasing livestock production. So the livestock were already there, they just lacked feed, and there were ready markets both domestically, and also Vietnam was wanting more beef, particularly cattle and buffalo, and there was a demand for pork from China and Thailand. So a bit of an export and a lot of increasing domestic demand as well. So what happened was we trained the staff initially in just basic technical aspects of forage production and extension, got them going on organising village meetings, conducting what we call a problem diagnosis with villagers, setting up and evaluating forage plots with farmers, and having regular follow-up visits. Not daily, like you've had with NACSA. Our extension staff probably visited once a week initially. So a key step was engaging villagers in identifying major problems. For them, it was primarily feed shortage and diseases. And then embarking on a problem-solving approach with farmers to find solutions. 200 farmers self-selected to trial various forage options in small plots. You can see some of the... So very small areas, but this was better than having nothing. But these farmers were motivated to overcome critical feed shortages during the dry season, when native grasses and forest vegetation is scarce. but also during the wet season when livestock are constrained to stop them damaging crops. The opportunity to save time and labour up to 5 hours per day looking for daily feed and cooking it, in the case of pigs, was the main motivational driver. And this was often the women and children who went out, you know, for up to 5 hours a day just looking for feed for the animals. So the fact that they could just plant these new forage varieties out the back door saved them a lot of time and effort. Farmers also wanted to keep livestock close to home to avoid theft or injury and to look after sick animals. Their traditional system was just to let them wander everywhere, so they had no control over their management. Many farmers expressed a desire to improve weight gain of their livestock, although this was secondary to reducing labour input and livestock mortality. So we heard yesterday about you have to have economic drivers for farmers. It has to be lead to more income. Yeah, that's important, but for really poor farmers, often it's the other motivational things are about just saving time, saving labour, making life easier. Additional income is good, but for subsistence farmers, like we were dealing with here, some of these other aspects were just as important. So within 2 or 3 years, the households began to demonstrate livelihood benefits. We started getting these benefits started to show. Labour savings, increased productivity, more security, income to buy rice, and a very important aspect was having a bit of income to send the kids to school rather than keeping them at home and telling them to go out and collect food for their livestock. So they were the benefits that started to flow. So this diagram here shows the scaling out process, what happened as we scaled out in terms of the numbers. So we kept a record of the numbers of farmers who were participating. And down the bottom there, I don't know if you can see, hopefully you can, the key extension activities that we used through this process. So the number of villages and farmers growing forages increased from 38 to 480 by the end of 2002. You can see here. That's what we started off with. Number of villages across there, number of farmers. Can you guess what the minus number is? Yes, people who stopped. So it's really important if you're going to evaluate your scaling out to record people who are stopping and to understand why. So we went out periodically to interview farmers. We called it an adoption tree, just the actual numbers, but we also went out periodically to interview and talk to farmers about what they were doing and why. This one circle here shows it's very easy to just have numbers. Okay, this is the number of people that are participating and registering with the society, but what's actually happening? What impacts are they getting? I think that's what Richard was getting to yesterday. What we found was the number of households with significant impacts, such as systematic fattening of cattle, housing and vaccinating of pigs, or reducing upland rice areas, was relatively small. So, you know, in 2 years, we weren't really getting significant impact. Upland farmers were gradually changing from livestock keepers to livestock producers, but only on a very small scale. So what we needed to do, a new strategy was needed to accelerate expansion of forages and benefits to more farmers. So we started facilitating farmer learning across villages and districts using, as I've got down there, cross visits, taking farmers from new villages to look at what was happening in the successful places, and also documenting case studies and showing those to new farmers. So what this led to a rapid expansion of the number of villages involved, and we started to get more and more significant impacts happening. But to do that, of course, we had to increase the number of staff who were working on the project. So it's sort of doubled. So documenting the impacts of whatever you're doing is really important. It's not only important for the funders and the organised to understand what's happening, but it can be used as an extension tool. In our case, because it's such a remote area, it was very difficult travelling. We couldn't readily, it cost a lot of money to take farmers from one province to another. So a cheap and easy way to do it was just to have these case studies on paper and just to show them what other farmers were doing in other areas. But it also helped us to get a handle on the economic and other livelihood benefits. And we trained the extension staff to do those case studies. We didn't have a consultant coming in from outside. It was the local staff who collected this information, went out to interview the farmers, took photos of them, and it helped them to understand the difference between, you know, lots of people just planting forages and the actual benefits from those forages, because they didn't really understand that to begin with. We did a little study on, we wanted to find out with these different extension methods that we're using, which ones were most effective. So we did a little study on comparing using case studies versus a cross visit versus having what we call a champion farmer or role model type of farmer to go to a village and talk. So we had some village, we had some villages where we just showed them case studies, some where we took on cross visits, and other ones where we had a farmer visit. And then we went out and interviewed them on what is the most valuable learning method for you. And you can see here that cross visits, regardless of what they've been exposed to, some farmers have never even been on a cross visit, but they all said that is the ideal. We want to go and see what other farmers are doing in the field. So the old seeing is believing, I think, really does work. So we've continued to use cross visits. And as we've had more and more, as you scale out, of course, you get more good examples close to home. So it starts off being quite expensive to begin with. You might have to take farmers to another province, but over time, they can just go down the road to the next village and have a look. So it's getting that process going. So the process I've described so far was driven and facilitated by donor-sponsored extension via the government system. So it was AusAid, and in the case of me evaluating this process, it was ACR delivering through the livestock department. However, in some districts, a spontaneous and dynamic expansion of forages became evident from 2005. One such district is Nong Het, a northeastern district of Zeng Quang bordering Vietnam and dominated by the Hmong ethnic group. Hmong farmers have a long history of cattle husbandry. They came down from China about 200 years ago and brought their cattle with them. They practice stall feeding of bulls for the new year. They have bullfighting festivals. You can see here the guys all crowding around waiting to see who the winner's going to be. So they really love the concept of having better feed for their bulls because they're very valuable. Although most of the cattle graze large extensive areas in communal herds, some of their herds are around 200 or 300 head, the opportunity to quickly fatten cattle and buffalo for the Vietnam trade was not lost on these producers. These Hmong farmers are very businesslike, very astute, and there were traders coming across from Vietnam every day saying, we want your cattle, we want your buffalo. So they saw a very lucrative business. So the use of forages, the uptake, and livestock fattening expanded rapidly in 2005 from the original. This is where we facilitated farmer learning and use of the technology here. But by 2007, it became evident that farmers outside these villages were buying and exchanging forage cuttings. So it naturally expanded by itself without us even having to try. Information exchange was facilitated via family or clan networks, but also dedicated extension officers. And those extension officers were Hmong, so they spoke the same language, they understood the culture. So by 2008, we found that the expansion had started to occur out here as well. So this is unfacilitated. In a lot of cases, it was unfacilitated scaling out. It just happened by itself because of the nature of this ethnic group and the market demand. So by 2008, we had a total of 50 villages. 45% of all villages in the district were growing over 200 hectares of forages involving 600 households, of which 66% were fattening. So that's been our major success story. So you never underestimate the spin-off effects of what can happen. You know, and with your deliberations with how to scale out shrimp, it might be that you don't have to focus on every area. That in some areas it will happen by itself if the farmers are entrepreneurial enough. One of the important things we found with the success of this scaling out was capacity building of the staff at the national, provincial and local level. So we worked at all those three levels. Staff were trained in workshops and in the field. We used mentors and regular meetings to build their technical and extension confidence. This is what we found in Indonesia, as Richard said, that often, you know, extension staff are straight out of college or university. They might have a bit of theory, but they just lack confidence. They haven't had enough practical experience. So we got them out in the field, learning from each other, learning from more senior staff here. We assigned mentors to each team, regular, at least monthly meetings where they would come together and share their problems and experiences within their district, but also every 6 months have a big workshop where they would come together and report on what was happening. This shows some training workshops that we've done in Indonesia with the aquaculture extension staff. We even did a study to evaluate the effectiveness of different capacity building methods. So there's a tendency often in projects to run a lot of workshops. But, you know, what about on-the-job learning? How important is that? Is mentoring? How important is that? So we were able to evaluate the relative importance of these different methods. I had a master's student from Laos doing that. And what we found was that a combination of getting a good balance between on-the-job learning, regular workshops and mentoring. If you don't have mentoring, that seemed to be a significant factor in their development. Okay, so just to sort of some take-home messages, I'm going to show a digital story. We've used digital stories for farmer case studies. So we've moved from the paper-based case studies to on a CD now. We can give farmers a CD. Most of them have CD players because they like karaoke. And they can watch a little video or digital story about other farmers, as well as technical instructions. So we trained staff in how to make these digital stories. If you want to, I'm only going to show one, which is about some take-home messages about scaling out. But if you want to find out more about our scaling out, you can go to this website here. All the information for our project is at that website, which is at Charles Sturt University. So we've got lots of case studies, reports, papers, things like that. So we'll go to the little video. So I'll just leave you to watch. It's got Lao music in it, which I hope you'll enjoy. No, it's that one up the top, yeah. So I'll just leave you with that and then I'll answer questions.